Will Price and Courtney Barnett. Tickets and more info at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, the Trump administration prepares for a widening deployment in U.S. cities. Ron Elving on the week in politics. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy's face-off with the Senate Committee over vaccines. A new film on twins left suddenly twinless. And Russ and Daughters, a smoked fish family on New York's Lower East Side for more than a century.
Our food especially is the food of memory. And so it's through the food that you connect with others and you connect with who you are and where you come from.
First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, September 6, 2025.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. Hundreds of Iron Rangers packed into the Iron Trail Motors Event Center in Virginia on Wednesday. They were there for a chance to comment on the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's new wastewater permits for Keetac. Megan Buffington attended and has more.
The PCA had to open up additional space for the 400 miners, environmentalists, and politicians. The presentation, Q&A, and comments swam through the complex history of the state's wild rice sulfate standard and its enforcement, and what that means for Keetac Mine and the Iron Range now and into the future. Here's the simple version. Minnesota law limits sulfate to 10 parts per million in water to protect wild rice. That's even lower than the drinking water standard. For various reasons, that limit hasn't really been enforced in the 50 years it has existed. The PCA says Keetac has until April 2030 to comply with the limit. U.S. Steel asked for a variance, but the PCA denied it. The PCA used a lottery system to decide who got to comment at the meeting. About 40 people got to speak of the over 150 who signed up. If you had to split it, about 60% were Iron Rangers who opposed the PCA decision. Most expressed fear of the economic repercussions and questioned the basis of the standard. Chad Daniels has worked in the mines for almost 30 years.
This standard isn't right. At some point we'll get it right and we'll comply with it, it'll make sense. But are we going to put these companies and these jobs our business and get rid of them, and it's too late at that point?
U.S. Steel estimates it will cost the mine hundreds of millions of dollars to meet the standard, which the PCA agrees with. And Keetac's only the first mine that will have to do so. It doesn't help that hundreds of miners are currently laid off and U.S. Steel is being sold. The other 40% of speakers were environmental and indigenous advocates, who say the enforcement of the rule is long overdue. Mike Maleska is a retired miner from Hibbing.
The company doesn't want to pick up the tab. Instead, they want you to raise your voices to pressure the MPCA to eliminate the only water quality standard we have so they can continue to pollute, setting the stage for even worse desecration of our rivers and lakes for our kids to deal with.
The draft permit and variance decision are open for public comment through September 22nd. Megan Buffington, KAXE News.
With a new school year here, roughly 150,000 Minnesota K-12 students are receiving special education services. Districts are mandated to craft learning plans for kids with disabilities, but for parents, requests can sometimes involve a maze of phone calls, documents, and meetings. State data show growth in families asking for support, like individualized education programs. The demand comes amid greater awareness of neurological disorders, including autism. Advocates say after a diagnosis, parents encounter a process where school staff want to ensure the child's needs meet certain criteria before an IEP is put in place. The Pacer Center's Beth James assists families in these situations.
That line is not super clear. And so that's what makes it really difficult because it's so highly individualized. However, a student does have to demonstrate educational need in order to be eligible for those special education services.
That means the school has to see evidence of the disability affecting a student's learning. If staff says the time isn't right for an IEP, parents have options, including an evaluation done by the school. If there's no resolution, they can seek a formal conference with the district and possible mediation facilitated by the state. PACER encourages parents to connect with an advocate, get everything in writing, and if successful, prepare to have their plan reviewed each year. Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for this story. The Minnesota Department of Transportation will host a public meeting as part of its corridor study along Highways 2 and 169 in Grand Rapids. The proposed alternative that will be discussed at the meeting Wednesday includes replacing several traffic signals with roundabouts and proposing a three-lane model for the corridor. The meeting will begin at 5 p.m. at Yanmar Arena in Grand Rapids. That's it for the Up North Report. Find more of our stories at KAXE.org, where you can also find content from our music, morning show, and Phenology teams. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
Weekend edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. President Trump is increasing his threats to send the National Guard into several major cities, even after a federal judge said that his use of troops in Los Angeles back in June was illegal. The president says he would deploy the Guard to cities that include Chicago, Baltimore, and New Orleans for public safety, despite data showing crime down in those cities. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf is in Chicago. Kat, thanks for being with us.
Hey, good morning.
What do we know now whether or not the president's going to deploy the National Guard there?
Well, Trump has said that he will, but hasn't been specific about a time frame. Here he is earlier this week at a press conference talking about Chicago.
Well, we're going in. I didn't say when. We're going in. When you lose, look, I have an obligation. This isn't a political thing. I have an obligation.
You know, since then, an official has confirmed to NPR that the Department of Homeland Security has requested assistance from the Pentagon for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, in the Chicago metropolitan area. The official spoke on the condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to speak publicly. ICE and the National Guard are different. The Guard is part of the military. ICE is federal law enforcement. But in D.C., for example, Trump's deployment of the National Guard came with a larger presence from ICE, too. Trump maintains that the National Guard would be sent here for public safety. You heard him there saying that this wouldn't be a political move. He sees it as an obligation. But generally, the National Guard is not used for policing. They can't make arrests or anything like that. In D.C., they've been patrolling federal property and picking up trash, that sort of thing.
Elected officials in Chicago are not in line with this, are they?
No, definitely the Democrats here are not. Here in Chicago, Governor J.B. Pritzker, a Democrat and a big opponent of Trump, has come out strongly against it. In a statement, he said, quote, none of this is about fighting crime or making Chicago safer. And many other local politicians here, you know, senators, aldermen, have said similar things. Democratic lawmakers in many other cities, Baltimore, for example, have said they plan to push back if Trump follows through with his threats. In Louisiana, though, Republican Governor Jeff Landry says he would welcome the troops if Trump sent them to New Orleans. And, you know, Trump himself has recently made crime an even bigger part of his political agenda, hoping that voters see big city crime as a major problem. And he seems to think that his crackdown on it, while mostly performative, will play out well for Republicans in the midterms next year.
And what's the latest on the legal challenges?
Well, earlier this week, a federal judge in California ruled that Trump's deployment of the National Guard there in L.A. in June violated a federal law that limits the use of the military for domestic law enforcement. But that ruling, which the Trump administration can appeal, only applies in California. In D.C., where the National Guard has been deployed for about a month, Trump has the authority to do so because of what's called the Home Rule Act that gives him command of D.C.'s National Guard. But that, too, doesn't apply to these other cities. You know, I'll note that even in D.C., D.C.'s attorney Attorney General still sued the Trump administration on Thursday over that deployment, saying it's illegal. There are times when the National Guard can legally be used in civilian law enforcement, but generally speaking, it has to be requested by each state's governor. Many experts say that what we're seeing here, with it being potentially forced on states, is uncharted territory, and it'll almost certainly lead to a lot more litigation.
And NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Chicago. Kat, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And for more on the possible deployment of troops, we're joined by NPR's Ron Elving. Ron, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
What is your judgment as to whether President Trump will send the National Guard to Chicago and other places?
He says he will. But as we have seen with tariffs, this president will set a policy by decree or threaten to do so, then reverse himself a short while later. And let's remember that the federal court in California has said he exceeded his authority by intervening with troops in Los Angeles this summer. Now, the National Guard deployment here in Washington is also in court, but Trump likes to keep his options open. He may want to wait to see what else happens in the days ahead. Next week, the week after, which stories are dominating the news? Will they be stories he wants, or will he want to direct attention elsewhere? Like you, Scott, I grew up in that city, Chicago. I know something of its crime history, what it costs people who live there. But does that current situation there or in Washington, is it anything like what we saw in L.A. last summer or in the Rodney King riots there in 1992?
There were disappointing job figures yesterday. U.S. employers added just 22,000 jobs in the month of August. What should we make of this?
It was a reality check, and in more ways than one, Trump has said the economy is doing great. These numbers say we may need some policy changes to avoid a recession. So just how bad was this report? Well, Trump went on social media to dismiss it and then changed the subject to talking about the Epstein files, which is usually his least favorite subject and which was back this week in the news, with the spotlight shifting to the victims. But on the jobs report, it is now clear that the weak jobs report a month ago was not an anomaly, nor the work of a labor official who had been appointed by another president. Trump fired that official. Yet this new report was way worse, not just in the number of new jobs created or the jobless rate going up, but in the index of actual hours worked, perhaps the purest measure of labor output. Of course, the silver lining on this cloud was the pressure on the Federal Reserve Board that Trump wants to lower interest rates. But that now seems almost certain to happen this month, and still, a silver lining on a cloud does not dispel the cloud itself.
And President Trump signed an executive order on Friday to rebrand the Department of Defense. Here's how he explained the decision.
So we won the First World War, we won the Second World War, we won everything before that and in between, and then we decided to go woke and we changed the name to Department of Defense. So we're going Department of War.
Ron, what do you make of the name change? What could it signal?
I think many will see this as just another roadside distraction, and maybe it is purely cosmetic, but it also has a more troubling side. It seems to signal that the president, the commander-in-chief, wants to go on the offensive. He says out loud, we've been too defensive in Ukraine, and he makes it known he won't hesitate to blast a boat in open waters if he thinks it's carrying dangerous narcotics from Venezuela. That happened this week, too.
And on Friday, the president posted on social media that India and Russia seem to have been lost to, quote, deepest, darkest China, as he put it, this coming after their leaders held, obviously, high-profile talks with China's president. What do you make of how we should view this moment?
Deepest, darkest China. Deepest, darkest China. Oh, my. There does seem to be a lot going on in this particular social media post. But what was going on with this three-way celebration of these countries? A new global order in the making? It's a widely shared opinion that the U.S. has pushed India away with Trump's tariff policies. And it's anyone's guess where Trump stands from day to day with either President Putin or President Xi. And if these three nuclear powers, including the world's two most populous nations, are forming some kind of a bond and offering something together to other nations around the world, that is troubling. And it makes you wonder how much of it is attributable to willful disengagement by the U.S., the country that once aspired to world leadership.
NPR senior contributor Ron Elving, thanks so much for being with us, Ron.
Thank you, Scott.
Susan Stamberg once began an interview with an orchestra conductor by asking a question she confessed she'd always wanted to ask someone in his line of work. Don't your arms get tired? Maestro Jorge Mester of the Louisville Orchestra told her, you know, it's the most obvious question and never gets asked. Said his right arm was a little heavy, but added that only unemployed conductors' arms get tired. It stayed in good condition. Listening to Susan Stamberg reminded us that often the best questions are short, simple, and open-minded. She's been the master of that art. This week, Susan Stamberg is putting down her microphone after more than 50 years at NPR. She's won shelves of major awards in broadcasting and has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, especially extraordinary for someone who became a star on the radio. And many of us at NPR feel that we are here today because of Susan Stamberg. She gave personality to a fledgling network that was almost an afterthought in the Public Broadcasting Act. News voices in the 1970s tended to be somber, accentless, and almost exclusively male. Susan Stamberg became the first woman ever to anchor a national evening news broadcast in the U.S. when she began to co-host All Things Considered in 1972. She was serious as the news required, but she was also curious, relentless, and utterly delightful. Susan's voice made Americans say, they sound different, don't they? Her voice has been sharp, sometimes saucy, and could be silken, then let out a bell-ringing laugh. She turned What is NPR into Have You Heard NPR? Today, they're women at all ranks and responsibilities in what we now call media, working as correspondents, anchors, news directors, CEOs, and more. They have entered through a crack that Susan Stamberg helped break through broadcasting's dense male wall. I heard Susan Stamberg's voice when I was a young reporter in Chicago, and Linda Wertheimer, and Nina Totenberg, and Cokie Roberts, and Noah Adams, and Bob Edwards, and I thought, I want to join that merry band. They're telling important stories differently. Susan Stamberg retires this week, but the sound and work of the place she helped found continues in all who have followed her voice to NPR. Susan has lifted us up for 50 years, and her arms have not grown tired.
Bit by bit, putting it together. Piece by piece, only way to make a work of art. Every moment makes a contribution, every little detail plays a part. Having just the vision's no solution, everything depends on execution. Putting it together, that's what counts.
The board of the foundation is meeting next week.
Ounce by ounce, putting it together.
You'll come to lunch.
Small amounts, adding up to make a work of art. First of all, you need a good foundation, otherwise it's risky from the start. Takes a little cocktail conversation, but without the proper preparation, having just the vision's no solution. Everything depends on execution. The art of making art is putting it together, bit by bit.
Thanks, Mrs. Stamberg. You're listening to NPR News.
It's 7:18. Good morning. Thanks for listening to KAXE and Weekend Edition. I'm Jennifer Barr. You can pay nothing to get that old or damaged car towed away, even if it doesn't run. Your donation of a car, boat, or other vehicle is tax deductible. You can save time and money while defending the KAXE programs that you love. Call 855-277-2346 for details. Weather today, partly sunny with highs in the upper 50s to low 60s, northwest winds 5 to 20. Tonight, partly cloudy, lows 35 to 40, and tomorrow, mostly sunny and a bit warmer, high 60 to 64. And now a message from the Minnesota Department of Health. Sometimes you just need to talk about it, but it can be hard to find someone who really listens. That's why there is 988 with support that meets you where you are. Confidential and staffed by trained folks who want to help when you need someone to talk to. Call or text 988 or chat online at 988lifeline.org. Join us Saturday, September 6th for Grand Rapids River Fest. I'm Jennifer Barr, and I am so excited for this year's lineup. Music starts at 3 o'clock with Alan Sparhawk, a prolific and versatile musician best known as the frontman of Low. His many side projects over the years reveal a musician unafraid to experiment. Then we'll hear Jeremy Albino. His songs are grounded in the gritty storytelling of classic country music propelled by the rhythms of old school R&B. And then Margot Price. She has something to say but nothing to prove, and in just a few solo albums she has cemented herself as a force in Americana music. We'll end our night with Courtney Barnett, one of Australia's most successful musical exports. She has played many festivals around the world, including Coachella, Bonnaroo, Lollapalooza, and now Grand Rapids River Fest. Find tickets and more info at grandrapidsriverfest.com. See you September 6th.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where visitors can unwind on white sand beaches and dine at restaurants. More at visitspc.com. From Americans United for Separation of Church and State, since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at au.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. faced questioning from lawmakers Thursday this week about vaccines, and it turned into a spectacle. Here's one exchange between Kennedy and Democratic Senator Ben Ray Lujan from New Mexico.
Mr. Secretary, you choose to know answers to questions with some colleagues.
And I'm willing to give you the answer.
Secretary, someone should have asked you, maybe President Trump should have asked you, are you a trustworthy person? And we should have waited for an answer then. Let's move on.
I don't even know what you're talking about. You're talking gibberish.
And we're now joined by NPR health correspondent Rob Stein. Rob, thanks so much for being with us.
Nice to be here, Scott.
Hearings lasted 3 hours. What were the highlights?
You know, Scott, I've covered a lot of pretty heated congressional hearings, but Kennedy's grilling was unlike anything I can remember. Everyone expected the Democrats on the committee to go after Kennedy, especially after he got his CDC director fired because she clashed with him over his vaccine policies, prompting a leadership implosion at the agency. But they were joined by some Republicans, including Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming.
Over the last 50 years, vaccines are estimated to have saved 154 million lives worldwide. I support vaccines. I'm a doctor. Vaccines work. Secretary Kennedy, in your confirmation hearings, you promised to uphold the highest standards for vaccines. Since then, I've grown deeply concerned.
But you know, Scott, Kennedy remained combative and defiant throughout the hearing, often, as we heard, shouting over senators as they questioned him and having angry exchanges about who's telling the truth.
And in line with that, Rob, can you help us do a little fact-checking? For example, Secretary Kennedy says that children receive too many shots, as many as 92, by the time they're 18. Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, that one left a lot of experts scratching their heads. So I checked with the American Academy of Pediatrics, and they told me, no, it's not accurate. Kids get no more than 38 vaccine doses for childhood diseases like measles, mumps, chickenpox, you know, polio, maybe closer to 50 if you count annual flu shots, but that's far fewer than 92. And there's plenty of evidence that those shots are very safe and highly effective at protecting kids from diseases that can be, you know, very dangerous.
Another statement the Secretary kept making was that he had done nothing to limit access to vaccines, including the COVID-19 vaccines. Is that true?
Well, you know, nothing he's done so far has actually totally pulled any vaccines from the market, but he has made getting a COVID shot a lot harder for a lot of people. And that's because for the first time, the vaccines aren't available to anyone 6 months and older to just walk into a pharmacy and get. The new shots are now only approved for people who face the greatest danger of getting really sick from COVID, you know, because they're 65 years old or older or have certain other medical issues.
How hard is it to get a COVID shot now?
You know, for a lot of people, it's probably way harder, especially right now. In some places, people are having a really difficult time finding pharmacies that even have the vaccine. And when they do, they're sometimes being turned away because they don't meet the new rules. Sometimes they can't even get it if they do meet those new criteria, and even if they come back with a prescription. You know, that's partly because the rules vary from state to state, and a lot of doctors and pharmacists are confused by the new rules, too. Now, you know, Scott, some of this will probably ease up in the coming weeks when the updated shots come into pharmacies more plentiful around the country and people get more familiar with the new rules, and possibly after a key CDC committee issues formal recommendations for the COVID vaccines later this month. But Scott, that committee was handpicked by Kennedy, so no one's sure exactly what they're going to do.
NPR health correspondent Rob Stein, thanks so much for being with us, Rob.
You bet, Scott.
Some people cook by the book, others by memory or by taste. But on tomorrow's Weekend Edition Sunday with Aisha...
Listen to this. There's a wet bubble, which is different from a dry sizzle. See what I mean?
We hear from a chef who can tell if his favorite dish is ready by the sound it makes. For more on the story, just tell your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. Losing someone close to you can feel like losing part of yourself. Imagine what that kind of loss is like for someone who's a twin and loses someone they have been with since their first breaths. The film Twinless is a meditation on that grief through two main characters, Roman and Dennis. Roman is straight. His twin brother was gay. Dennis is gay. His deceased twin brother was straight. They made it a support group for twins left behind, and their banter is awkward and funny.
Hey, do you get car sick?
Yeah, sometimes. Why?
Rocky always had to sit in the front seat when we were kids. And I don't know. I just thought maybe that was connected to, like, the gay gene, if there is one.
Well, there is a gay gene. We see orange is blue and blue is orange. That's why there's so many homosexuals in the fashion industry.
Oh, see? Well, there you go.
I'm sorry, you know that I'm joking, right? That's not true.
Yeah, no, I knew that.
But also, a bit of a mystery with complex twists. The film stars Dylan O'Brien and James Sweeney, who also wrote and directed the film. They both join us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having us, Scott.
Thank you. That was also an immaculate introduction.
What a lovely intro.
James Sweeney, what inspired the script?
Oh, boy.
I have always been fascinated by twins. I grew up in a generation that I think twins were imprinted on us in a moment of cultural zeitgeist, from the Olsen sisters to Sister on the Disney Channel. I think the idea of twins catered to my particular yearning for intimacy, a sibling who shares your face, shares your thoughts, somebody who completes you. I do have an older sister, but she's 10 years older. And as somebody who hopped around growing up because my dad is in the Air Force, I think there was something very appealing about somebody who I could share my life with. Then I also dated an identical twin in my early 20s, and I wrote the first draft of Twinless shortly after he broke up with me.
Dylan O'Brien, you play Roman and his twin brother, Rocky.
Yes.
Relationship was a little rocky, if you please.
Hey, nicely done.
How did you prepare for those roles?
Well, there's a multitude of stages in the process, I guess. First, reading the piece initially, I felt really instinctively connected to the Roman character in particular. And he's the living twin. He's a little more repressed. He's a little more sheltered. And I had a very just sort of innate, I guess, understanding of this character from a really human and emotional standpoint. And then in the case of the other brother, James and I spoke a lot about the differences that we wanted to prioritize between the twins, down to their walk, their energy. And then at the end of the day, you just kind of have the end result.
And James Sweeney, let me ask you, your character Dennis seems so much to be gentle and sweet, but he can also be obsessive and, if I may, even frightening. How did you put all those elements into that character?
Well, I'm wrestling with what to disclose here, in part because I hope that audiences can go in as blindly as possible. What I will say is, as an actor, you try not to think too much about whether or not you're likable. You don't want to judge the character. I think you just try to play the honesty of each moment.
I had to look it up. There are support groups for twins who are in grief. And I wonder, did you attend any?
I did not attend a twinless support group. I didn't feel it would be appropriate. I tried to do as much research as I could in terms of twin psychology and twin bereavement and trying to portray that as authentically as I could. One thing I did think that was interesting that we do sort of integrate into the storyline is this idea that twins who are extremely close growing up, I'm particularly referring to identical twins, often have a easy access to building immediate intimacy, which I think is something that can have long-term effects on all the relationships in your life. And I think that's something that we see between Roman and Dennis is a strong need for intimacy. I think they find solace in each other. I think for Roman, he sees Dennis as not a replacement for his late brother, but potentially an opportunity to build a relationship as an adult with Dennis in a way that he had lost with Rocky.
That brings up a scene that's difficult. It's in a hotel room, and Dennis asks Roman to pretend that he's Rocky and let him talk.
I'm sorry, I can't control my anger. I'm sorry, I blew up with you when you told me you like guys. I'm sorry I called you a I wish I could take it back. All in your face when I said it. Like, I know that's why you left. I think I was scared that if you weren't like me and we weren't the same, and then I wouldn't know who I was.
How did you pull that out of yourself?
Some things in the screenplay change over time, but this was always something that word for word stayed the same. I, going into the day, wanted to honor it word for word. This is a really roundabout way of saying that I'm really trying to credit James here because so much of my inspiration and, you know, how you say what I had to pull out of myself was made easy by being so inspired and genuinely connected to what was put on the page for me. Having the pleasure of coming in and reading these words that broke me from the first time that I ever read them.
Is there something in this film that we can learn about male friendships, maybe even between gay and straight men?
Short answer is yes.
This is NPR. We take the longer answer, don't you worry.
I was like, so far the format feels like it wants the latter.
Whereas in maybe more formative years of my life, I tended to be more attracted to female friendships, which I felt were easier to navigate for me. Also, I think that's very common for gay men. It's been surprising to me that in my late 20s and now in my early mid-30s that I've had such close relationships with straight men. And I think one of the things that's surprising about Roman, which I think is also something that he is learning from because of the loss of his brother, there is a surprisingly sensitive side to a character who in another movie you might otherwise see as somebody who is brutish. So I think there is something very admirable about the friendship and how they both at times lift each other up, and when they see each other as vulnerable, try to be present. I think that's something that we could all use.
Mr. O'Brien?
Yeah, I mean, growing up, you know, as a straight man, I was very much involved in kind of conventionally like straight things, surrounded by like other boys who were being raised to be like boys, you know what I mean? But in my home life, I was very much so tied to my mother. My father was in the picture too, but he was more so in and out with his work. So I, like James, I've always have related to an innate comfortability in female relationships. And it's interesting to sort of observe my male friendships, I can see them struggle with vulnerability a little more, you know, merely because very commonly it's just like not something that they're taught.
I do wonder, how would both of you feel about somebody who sees your film, who walks out of it, who says, well, all of that's very interesting, but you know what? It was really funny.
That's fine. That's great, yeah.
James Sweeney and Dylan O'Brien, their new movie, Twinless, is now in theaters. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having
us. Thank you dearly.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. President Trump has sparked redistricting fights in Texas, California, and other states that could reshape the political map. But as NPR's Hansi Lo Wang reports, some longtime opponents of gerrymandering are now reconsidering their position.
Ready for some more chants? Here we go.
In 2019, Common Cause took their campaign against partisan gerrymandering all the way to the Supreme Court.
Hey, hey, ho, ho, gerrymandering's got to go. Hey,
but the advocacy group has softened its stance in recent weeks.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. So I'm here to describe our six fairness criteria.
When its senior vice president of policy, Omar Nuruldeen, helped announce that Common Cause will not condemn certain gerrymandered maps of voting districts, and they see as proportional to the threat posed by gerrymanders in other states.
We had to pivot our position to meet this current moment because we are not in normal times.
We have an opportunity in Texas to pick up five seats.
President Trump has been making a vocal push on CNBC and other platforms for new congressional maps that could help preserve Republican control of the U.S. House of Representatives after next year's midterm election.
And we are entitled to five more seats.
They fired the first shot, Texas.
And in response, California's Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom led a counter push for a ballot measure in November. It's set to ask the state's voters to allow a new gerrymandered map that could help Democrats pick up five House seats.
We wouldn't be here at Texas not done what they just did. Donald Trump didn't do what he just did.
At the same time, we saw the president deploy the National Guard in D.C.
Nuruldeen says Common Cause has changed its position on gerrymandering because it fears Trump's moves could ultimately make him and Congress unaccountable to voters and take away any future chance to make this country's representative democracy fairer.
Proposing an end to birthright citizenship, undermining the independence of the courts, using disinformation to weaken trust in our elections. And this redistricting fight fits right in. It's about locking in control of government no matter what voters want.
Had this been handled years ago, we wouldn't have been quite in this place.
Selena Stewart is a CEO of the League of Women Voters. The advocacy group, like Common Cause, has softened its position against gerrymandering and is now urging states not to harm racial and ethnic minorities, younger voters, and agricultural communities. Stewart says these ongoing redistricting fights are the result of the Supreme Court ruling in 2019, and partisan gerrymandering is not reviewable by federal courts.
That is part of how we have gotten here now, because of the unwillingness of the Supreme Court to put this in check. In addition to that, Congress has failed to act and pass legislation that would also standardize things.
During the Biden administration, Republicans blocked the Democratic push to pass a national ban on partisan gerrymandering. David Daley of Fair Vote, which supports nonpartisan redistricting, says that kind of ban would help, but the country also needs a different way of electing members of Congress.
I think we ought to be looking towards a House that is much more proportional.
Daley says the House could have multiple members representing each district. Advocates say proportional representation could help temper gerrymandering and political extremism.
Until we look really seriously at these problems and try to imagine the big structural fixes that can get us back on the right track, we are going to spiral towards the bottom and stay there.
But for now, Daley says he's watching for new gerrymander maps that may be passed soon in states like Missouri, Ohio, and Indiana. Hansi Lo Wang, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It's 7:39. You're listening to Weekend Edition here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Programming is supported by the Bush Foundation, accepting applications for the 2026 Bush Fellowship now through noon on October 7th. The Bush Fellowship invests in leaders and their capacity to do more good. Up to 30 leaders receive $150,000 to support their leadership plan. Visit bushfoundation.org. We also thank The Sewing Room, hosting the Cultivating Community Summit, a two-day gathering to explore belonging, workforce inclusion, environmental justice, and more. Taking place at the Gitche Zibi Center for the Arts in Brainerd, September 22nd and 23rd. Registration at sewingroom.org. That is S-O-W-I-N-G. Partly sunny today, highs in the upper 50s to low 60s, northwest winds 5 to 20, and for tomorrow, mostly sunny, warmer, high 60 to 64. Support comes from the Blandin Foundation Strengthening Rural Minnesota. More at blandinfoundation.org.
Snyder with these headlines. A federal judge has blocked the Trump administration from ending temporary legal protections from more than 1 million people from Haiti and Venezuela. The judge in California called Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem's decision to end protections granted by the Biden administration arbitrary and capricious. The Israeli military is urging all residents of Gaza City to evacuate to the Al-Mawasi area of Khan Yunus, a humanitarian zone in the south. Gaza City is the territory's largest urban area. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians have been sheltering there from nearly 2 years of fighting. And Hockey Hall of Fame goaltender Ken Dryden has died. The Montreal Canadiens announced his death from cancer early today. He was 78. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. It's Saturday morning. Would you like a little nosh? Bagel with lox and schmear? Latkes, babka, and rugula?
95.
Don't fetch. There's no better place than Russ and Daughters, which has been on New York's Lower East Side for 114 years.
So the tour is not that involved, but I mean, we can
you're
talk
giving
about
us
the
a
cases.
Tour of a place that is maybe 20 feet long.
Right, exactly.
But bustling with activity.
Exactly.
Josh Russ Tupper is a fourth generation Russ.
We have a bunch of appetizing in these showcases.
One of two cousins who now own and run the shop that's about the size of a subway car.
On the fish side, as we call it, we have whitefish, chubs, brook trout, sable, sturgeon, and our famous whitefish salad.
Oh, whitefish salad. The sides of glistening fish rest behind a glass that gives them a sultry, jewel-like glow next to tubs of pearly cream cheese.
Russ and Daughters, for me, was a literal mom and pop because it was my mom and my pop.
Nikki Russ Fetterman is the cousin who practically grew up at the shop.
As a kid, I would wait at the doors for the produce delivery guys to come, and they would wheel in with their hand carts. They had sacks, 50-pound sacks of onions, carrots, potatoes, and I would climb on top as if it were my chariot.
Nikki and Josh took over Russ and Daughters from Nikki's parents, and they've put together a new book. The reason for our visit today, it is rich with history, musings, and recipes drawn from a family's life in Lox, and more. Matzo ball soup, noodle kugel, smoked trout mousse. It's called Russ and Daughters, 100 Years of Appetizing. And why shouldn't we call Russ and Daughters a deli?
Because we're not a deli. We're one of the last remaining appetizing stores. Both come from Jewish dietary laws. So a delicatessen in its traditional form is a place you go for smoked and cured meats. So think pastrami, corned beef, for example. And then the appetizing store is for fish and dairy.
Over a century ago, when Joel Russ founded his business, that fish was herring.
My great-grandfather's older sister was a herring maven, and she sponsored him emigrating to the U.S. So our great-grandfather sold Schmaltz herring, which is just cured in salt, from the pushcart.
These days, the real draw at Russ and Daughters is
12, 13 different types of cold-smoked salmon.
I think that a bagel and lox is one of the literal tastes of New York.
Oh, boy, yeah.
This is a beautiful side of Gaspé Nova, the classic Russ and Daughters New York-style smoked salmon. Right.
Team of Slicers, an official job title, work behind the counter slicing salmon so thin you might be able to read the fine print on a cell phone contract through it. Is there somebody who can show me how to do it?
Yeah.
I mean,
D Do you want to try your hand at this job?
She moved a sharp, slender knife across an opulently orange side of salmon as surely as a New York Philharmonic violinist wields a bow.
I mean, even if you're not good at slicing, Scott, that's a pretty poetic assessment. As you move back and forth, you're continuing to feel the contact.
Yeah.
Between the back of the knife on the flesh as you move it down. You want to continue to see the blade going through the fish. I'm doing it slowly right now so you can see it.
Wow, that is so thin. That's amazing. And then...
On guard!
Sorry, I took a turn.
We'll see how you do.
Oh, geez.
Okay.
All right.
So just be very loose if you can. Don't grip too hard the handle of the knife.
My technique was more Freddy Krueger than Itzhak Perlman. Oh, this is no good at all.
But this is, it takes a long time.
3 months apprenticeship, says Nikki Russ Fetterman, to learn how to properly slice salmon. The artistry is amazing. What's it do for the taste?
So the thinness of the slice with the proper angle gives you that subtlety of flavor that you just don't get with a thick slice or a machine cut slice.
Yeah.
It's definitely not the most practical or fast way to do it, but it's the best way.
Can I try it one more time?
Yes, absolutely. Once you do, when you get the hang of it, this is actually quite meditative.
Yeah.
It also gives you a moment to connect with the person you're helping over the counter. So there's conversation
that
happens. It's beautiful.
Because they'll say, oh, you know, we have family coming over tonight, or...
Or they tell us their story about coming to Russ and Daughters, you know, when they were a kid, and now they're bringing their kids. There's always this interaction over the counter that is facilitated by the fact that you have to stand and wait and watch your salmon being sliced, your herring being cut, your cream cheese being spread. Our food especially is the food of memory. And so it's through the food that you connect with others and you connect with who you are and where you come from. You know, it's a time portal. It can transport you immediately to your past and to a memory.
At Russ and Daughters, the past is right outside the front door and around the corner on Orchard Street.
Actually, right here was where our great-grandfather first opened his shop.
Right here?
So
karaoke
first,
bar now.
He was probably on these streets. Before he could open a store, he worked for 7 years as a street vendor.
Today, it's home to boutique hotels, galleries, and trendy bars. But when Joel Russ arrived at the turn of the 20th century, this slice of New York teemed with newcomers.
People just packed into these tenement buildings. Really, this neighborhood, the Lower East Side, is probably one of the most historically significant places in the United States because we are an immigrant country and so many immigrants got their start here after arriving at Ellis Island. This was their landing spot.
A few more blocks down Orchard Street and we arrive at a fairly new addition to the family biz.
We found the latkes.
You're about to make latkes? A decade ago, Nikki Russ Fetterman and Josh Russ Tupper opened Russ and Daughters Cafe, a place to sit to nosh. And that's where we sat down over a plate of crispy latkes to talk about that history.
It's our understanding that Russ and Daughters is the first business in this country to have "and daughters" in its name. It wasn't the original name. One of the first names was Russ's Cut Rate Appetizing, because our great-grandfather had to, I guess, compete with the many other appetizing stores on the Lower East Side. You know, if there had been a son, it probably would have been Russ and Sons, but...
Then he had three daughters, and as we've been told, he wasn't the most pleasant of shopkeepers. What did he like to say? Lose the address?
So he would say, "Lady, do me a favor. Forget the address."
Forget the address.
If he didn't like you. At some point, he needed help, so he looked to his family, and his daughters came to work at a very young age.
Your father would tell the story of our great aunt Hattie was so good at like cutting the fish and be like, "Oh, this fish is so beautiful, it's wonderful," and she was like very charismatic and really good, and the customers would get into it. And then your father one day tried to do that to a customer. He's like, "Oh, look at the slices on this fish," and the customer's like, "Do me a favor, Don't fall in love with the merchandise. Didn't work at all.
Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg was a lifelong customer of ours.
Oh.
As a child, she would come and visit her grandparents. And she gave an interview where she said that growing up, seeing the name Russ and Daughters taught her that before she knew the word feminist, she learned that women could matter in an enterprise the same as men can.
Forgive me, before I ask my next question, I just have to have a little, yeah.
Come get a latke. So there's sour cream and applesauce is one classic combination, and then salmon roe comes fresh.
Are you having this?
That's that voice we know.
I mean, warm and potatoy on the inside, and then the hint of onion. God, this is, sorry. Oh, forgive me. I've never done an interview quite so
delicious.
If somebody comes up to you and says, what should I have here? What do you say?
We created this restaurant to have the sit-down appetizing experience. So really, the way you should eat this is 4+ people. Get your platter of smoked fish, order from the whole menu.
It was a little mishugana, that's the Yiddish word to say crazy, of us to think that we could open a restaurant because neither Josh nor I had any restaurant experience. But we did know our store and we knew our food. And sometimes it, you know, we would argue over things. Does matzo bread go on the menu? Does it not go on the menu?
Is it on the menu?
No.
Well,
oh.
It was.
Oh, what happened?
Turns out that the simplest dish is the hardest.
The most challenging. The
matzo bread was the bane of our existence.
Yeah.
How so?
Every person that ordered matzo bread had a memory.
Oh, of a matzo bread at home.
Their matzo bread, of course. Their grandmother's matzo bread, their mother's matzo bread, and they're all different. Sweet, savory.
Wet, dry.
Soggy matzo.
Peppery.
Dry matzo. Right. Basically, everyone who ordered was unhappy.
Because we could never match their taste memory. Now, you have to know to ask for matzo bread. So we'll make it for you, but you got to work a little hard.
Don't tell anyone else.
Okay, no. It'll stay between us. Don't you worry. I mean, you must be aware of the fact that, well, there are people undoubtedly who will wander in casually, but to a lot of people who come here and whose families have come here, I mean, let me put it this way. Russ and Daughters is not just another place to eat.
No, it's almost a pilgrimage site. A lot of people can trace their family histories and beginnings back to this neighborhood. Every day we're reminded of why this place and this food matters. And I realized also that we have fewer and fewer small businesses, these sort of touchstones in our communities that in a real way connect us to our past and anchor us in the neighborhoods we live in. And Russ and Daughters is that place for so many people. And so it's hard work, but it's a real joy to be able to be a steward of keeping this going.
Not to put too much pressure on our kids. We both hope that a fifth generation is, that's why we're doing this. We're holding the torch to pass on to the next generation.
Josh Russ Tupper and Nikki Russ Fetterman, their new cookbook is Russ and Daughters, 100 Years of Appetizing, and to sample their matzo bread recipe. That's matzo soaked in water, mixed with eggs and fried. You can go to npr.org. Our story was produced by Samantha Balaban. If you've ever wanted to be a bug-like creature swinging a sword, Hollow Knight might be the video game for you. Die-hard fans of this 2017 hit have waited years for its sequel. Hordes of players crashed online storefronts, snagging their copies of that sequel, Hollow Knight Silksong. And NPR's Kai McNamee explains how this indie game took over the video game world.
Gamescom in Cologne, Germany, is the world's largest video game convention.
Is it working? Am I live? Hi, everyone.
YouTuber Alan Ferretti Horst was there last month, live streaming from his tent on the convention campgrounds. Online, he goes by the name Blue SR, and he makes videos playing Hollow Knight. In the game, you play a knight exploring a two-dimensional world, hopping between platforms and slashing enemies. Ferretti Horst came to Gamescom for one thing, a playable demo of Hollow Knight's long-awaited sequel, Hollow Knight Silksong.
You should have seen the lines. It was crazy. There were so many people excited about it.
Even better than a demo, during the convention, the creators of the game announced Silksong would be released just 2 weeks later.
It honestly still doesn't feel real. I feel like at any moment I could pinch myself and wake up.
Zach Kazmierski runs a Reddit community dedicated to Hollow Knight. It's one of many online communities where people talk about the game, share fan art, hang out, and they've spent plenty of time waiting for Silksong. Over the years, speculation about Silksong's release whipped fans into bouts of frenzied excitement. Every year at major video game events, they would flock to the live stream and spam the chat with messages like, Silksong, when?
It was a little overwhelming, to tell you the truth. People can be a little bit overzealous about this series sometimes.
People kept wondering, is this going to be the Xbox event or the Nintendo Direct where Silksong finally shows up? And as the years went on, the silence just became totally deafening.
That's Bloomberg video game reporter Jason Schreier. The game's creators, Team Cherry, were almost completely silent during the sequel's development, which Schreier says only helped fuel the intrigue and draw more players to the game. Take 2019. That year, Team Cherry announced plans for a sequel, but didn't say when they'd release it. At that point, Hollow Knight had sold around 3 million copies. But as online chatter from expectant fans grew, so did sales. Today, that number is around 15 million copies. Fans of Hollow Knight will tell you its vast world, tight controls, and haunting score make it a perfect game. Riley Johnston breaks down video game design on her YouTube channel, Juniper Dev. She says the hand-drawn art sets Hollow Knight apart.
Every time that I went to like a new space in the map, like the Crystal Peaks, Green Path, Fog Canyon, just discovering all the different sound effects, the enemies, like they build the world so well that like genuinely all you can feel is just awe.
All that awe is the work of a very small crew. Team Cherry is a tiny studio made up of only 3 full-time staff. Jason Schreier says that's really astonishing.
Especially because you have comparative games that are made by thousands of people and don't sell nearly as many copies.
Team Cherry didn't respond to my request for an interview, but they explained to Schreier that the development of Silksong was smooth. They were just quietly working on the game, taking their time with it and not letting the online excitement distract them. Now, 6 years after Team Cherry announced the sequel, fans will finally see if Hollow Knight Silksong lives up to the hype. Kai McNamee, NPR News.
And this is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from AG1, maker of a drinkable multivitamin now available in 3 new flavors, tropical, berry, and citrus. Learn more at drinkag1.com. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
Good morning. It is coming up on 8 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, people-powered radio in northern Minnesota, operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. You can find us at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thanks so much for your support. Stay tuned for another hour of Weekend Edition, including the Up North Report, local news from our region. At 9 o'clock, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg. This week, it's the Sunrise Edition with stories from early risers. 10 o'clock this morning, Tom Daniel, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. Weather today, partly sunny, highs in the upper 50s to low 60s, northwest winds 5 to 20. Tonight, partly cloudy, lows 35 to 40, and tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs in the low to mid 60s. Support comes from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu at rapidsbrewingco.com. Today is the day. Grand Rapids River Fest is here. Gates open at 2 o'clock. Music starts at 3.